Hello, friends out there. This is Zakir Hussain, and you are listening to CKUT 90.3 on Radio McGill. Stay tuned, Montreal.
Tuned into Radio Rénoviction. I'm your host, Caroline Künzli, and today I'm going to share an interview I did almost 2 years ago with the founders of the Long Haul Art Studios, Vanessa Yanow and John Tinholt. For over 20 years, the Long Haul has offered affordable studios to local artists in the Park Extension neighborhood. But gentrification has hit this hood too, and it's changing everything. So as they cope with the Long Haul's very probable eventual demise, Vanessa and John share their thoughts on the role that artists play in the process of gentrification. Have a listen.
I'm Vanessa Yanow. I'm a visual artist, designer, and co-founder, coordinator of the Long Haul Studios, which is an artist studio collective in Park Extension, Montreal. And I'm co-founder with John.
My name is John Tinholt, and I co-founded The Long Haul / Le Corridor in Montreal with Vanessa 2001.
You founded The Long Haul, but you've also lived in Park Extension all of this time. Yeah, we've been living in Park X and working out of the studios and lived in The Long Haul as well for almost 21 years. Yeah, a long time. So we've seen the changes happen slowly and more pressingly in the last 6-7 years with the University of Montreal campus. Campus Mill having been built over the last 6-7 years, it's dramatically changed the landscape on a physical and cultural and economic level.
Can you talk about how it's changed? How you've seen it changed? And
I mean, just a basic thing is that we never used to see pedestrians on Beaumont, which is where the Long Haul is located. It's more of a highway to get to Acadie, to the 40. So pedestrians were a rare sighting on Beaumont. And now we see, I mean, I guess there's probably at least 2 people a minute, you know, walking by. That alone was a very kind of tangible change. We saw the Kosher Bakery, our beloved kosher bakery across the street, get torn down. It was initially bought, like scheduled to be bought by the City of Montreal in order to build social housing, a shelter, and the ground floor was supposed to be like affordable commercial rents for community organizations. We had received a letter 7 years ago about that purchase, that like pending purchase, and then everything went silent. And lo and behold, we heard through the grapevine and through the activist organizations in the neighborhood that Montoni is a developer, had actually bought it or decided to buy it, or I don't know technically. Apparently the reason why the City of Montreal didn't want to deal with it was because there was an extra $250,000 that they would have to invest to clean the lot, to decontaminate. And they didn't want to fork out that cash, and Montoni was ready to do that because they're going to dig anyway for parking, for condos, and that was the end of that. So we lost our beautiful sunset view, we lost our kosher bakery, and now we have a bunch of temporary, mostly students, living in this condo across the street because it's in proximity to the campus.
Okay, so there's condo buildings blocking what used to have a view. Yeah. But they're condos and there's students living in them. How do they afford?
Well, they're apartment rentals, but it has a real condo look. And I looked on their website and I went to their sales office and asked for prices and stuff. And like the cheapest studio apartment was, I think, $2,500. But yeah, they have like the townhouses are on the ground floor, and they're I think $4,500 a month.
It's obvious that Montoni's built something that they hope is going to reflect what this whole avenue is going to look like after it's been developed. Beaumont Avenue is like right on the edge of one of the poorest immigrant neighborhoods in Montreal, and where we are located is between Beaumont and the railroad tracks. So this is really a marginal location in lots of ways. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody's shortcut, so it's actually quite a busy street and really not an ideal place at all to build residences. But
and there's also some new businesses, I've noticed.
There's been slow, as you go up Beaumont, you can see all of the development that's been taking place because it's A, a super cheap property, and B, there's an assumption that because of the University of Montreal development on the other side of the tracks that the values for everything are going to go up in this neighborhood and that there's going to be more traffic. So they're trying to construct for the future, but it really stands out in the middle of the rest of the neighborhood, which is, like I said, mostly really, really low quality, poor immigrant apartments. And it's just been part of the general trend of investment and speculation and real estate in Park X in the last 10 years. I remember maybe 15 years ago, Vanessa and I, we were thinking of maybe trying to buy a house somewhere mm-hmm. in Park X. And went looking at prices and stuff, and it was pretty cheap. It was mm-hmm. like maybe $250,000 for like a house with a yard and et cetera and everything. And again, it's like not the posh neighborhood at all. It's like no. under the landing flight path of Dorval Airport. It's mm-hmm. like sandwiched basically between the railroad tracks here and the 40 up there.
The highway.
Major highway. But now there's nothing in this neighborhood that we could ever afford because everything has been purchased by speculators who want to turn it into big money. So
I mean, I wouldn't go as far as saying everything has been purchased. There's actually been a large migration of middle-class artists, lower middle-class artists, or entrepreneurs, people we know, I guess. With
regular people that don't have huge incomes.
Yeah, who have bought in Park X over the last 10 years. Because Mile End and Plateau were becoming prohibitively expensive. And so gentrification, it's like this insidious, slow trickle. It's almost like it's there as a ghost first, and then the thing that is not quite tangible or visible, but you've got a feeling. And then as it becomes more prevalent, it makes itself more apparent mm-hmm. and potentially, yeah, affecting those who are witness to it.
We were aware of this 20 years ago when we were looking to move in together and have a workspace and to look for places to live. And we were both in Mile End at the time.
I was in Little Italy.
Yeah, okay. Little Italy. And we very consciously looked in poor neighborhoods because the neighborhoods that we had been living in had gotten too expensive. In effect, we're kind of economic migrants running away from where everything is too expensive to mm-hmm. wear stuff. Just the general escape from capitalism that capitalism drives everybody to do, but that's where we were at.
Well,
so we were conscious of it at the time.
We're conscious of it, and we're conscious of being gentrifiers. And the way in which we kind of passively dealt with it was just to keep the lowest profile possible. For the first 10 years, we just made ourselves kind of invisible.
You consider yourselves gentrifiers. Can you say a bit more about what you mean? And also now you're questioning being invisible and wishing you had been more.
I guess with more education on, and I guess with more experience and with seeing how gentrification has affected like larger metropolises like New York City, San Francisco, and the ways in which those cities have suffered gentrification or dealt with it or responded to it has informed how I assess our positioning and our history here. I feel like, you know, we took the more kind of punk rock route, which was just to like no signage, no visibility, do our own thing, just sort of an underground scene. And as a result, there was no outreach to the existing community right. of newly landed immigrants, to the culturally rich and diverse community that is Park Extension. We were our own bubble, and that protected us from the city and inspectors and just kept the cool factor. And
well, we were always really shoestring anyway. I mean, it was
very shoestring.
Yeah, it's a very low budget.
Very low budget.
Yeah, our entire mandate is about keeping rent low for artists who need a space to work in.
And needing space to work doesn't mean that we need to be public. It's like so people can have their escape pod, have their sanctuary, have their space to just get to work. It's not a gallery.
Yeah.
So in some ways, we were not as damaging as, let's say, the New York scene where like, suburban kids, university, you know, PhD, master's track, visual artists move to Brooklyn so that they can like gain cultural capital and therefore end up making it as an art star in New York, you know. Mm-hmm. We had definitely links with Concordia, and we did more have a proportion of our artists come from Concordia University. And I think that's where things get really tricky with regard to artists and gentrification. There's the artists who move into these neighborhoods and then like want to impose their kind of like artiness and their conceptual, non-community oriented, very kind of capitalist affiliated work or practice in a place that therefore ends up not having any connection with the here and now and the place in which they're working from.
Very much the way gentrification happens in other neighborhoods is like the money comes in and it's attracted by the culture, but it does not bring any of its own. Kind of the opposite is true for us, is like we're kind of bringing our own culture that we're mostly here to produce it and then disseminate it in other places than our neighborhood, in a neighborhood that is mostly about people trying to survive. So again, there's like a disconnect between these outsiders coming into the place and then doing stuff that makes life more difficult for the people who were already here. Because when we came here in 2001, this building was almost abandoned. And the work that we had to do just to make our shoestring budget organization work was substantial. And we put our own money into it in order to make it happen. And our landlord a number of times has said, like, I don't know what we would have done with this building if you guys hadn't shown us that it still had value and that we could still do stuff with this place.
On the one hand, he commends us and shows gratitude for our inspiring them to do something with a building, but then on the other hand, he's sick of being the benefactor of like giving us a good lease and giving us good rent.
He would like to profit.
Well, he's just looking at the neighborhood and thinking, I could be making an awful lot more money with this 9,000 square feet that these guys have. Even though in the greater scheme of things, it will really not contribute very much to his overall bottom line. And even assuming that he is able to find a use for these spaces, because he has demonstrated to us many times that he has much higher hopes for different bits of the building than he's actually able to find tenants for. It's the speculation that's driving it. It's future money that is driving his actions now.
Right.
And again, that's part of the gentrification. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff just goes back to the whole idea of real estate as something that people can own. Once you start doing that, there becomes a market for it. And once there's a market for it, they become financial vehicles. They become investments and they stop being places. Or they become, insofar as they become investments, their value as places decreases. We've done things like being able to get funding to redo the front lawn of this building, which is completely irrelevant to the business of the building or to our existence here as well. It just makes it a nicer place. Mm-hmm. But we had to get funding.
It was city funding. And then an ecological group that added more funding to green, because this road was considered a gray zone.
Like, it was very industrial.
Like, it needed more oxygen, literally. And so we got funding to plant trees and bushes.
But those things, like, increased the value of our landlord's property, and he didn't have to pay anything for it. And he's happy to accept things like that, but less excited to have to invest in this thing because it cuts into his bottom line. And the bottom line really is the bottom line for this place. It's a way to make money, and that's it. And its value as a place is displaced by that priority.
Yeah, just to going back to, like, artists and our effect on gentrification, I think that unfortunately where we're at now as an organization, as we see our pending demise, we are finding time, and there is more funding out there for organizations like ours to be able to do artistic projects that are more activist oriented, that support emerging, not so professional artists, that also are more hybrid projects are being funded by Canada Council and Conseil des Arts de Montréal to do collaborations conversations with art organizations and community organizations, and that's where I think gentrification can be... It's inevitable, but the way in which artists can counter the harmful effects of gentrification is to do more activist art, to make work that pertains to the place, to seek out artists that are just emerging or who have practices that are more rooted in cultural...
Who are not professional artists trying to make a career as an artist, but...
Yeah, who are still creatives yeah. and have an interest in drawing or painting or singing or dancing. And if it's an integral part of their cultural heritage, like to find ways to collaborate and team up with members of the community in order for everybody to benefit and find joy in creation and in community. And that in and of itself is a form of activism, is a form of countering the capitalist culture, because it's not rooted in any bottom line endgame. And this is where we're, as an org, we're seeking projects that are more in touch with our location
and the people in this neighborhood. Yeah.
Yeah.
When we came in, I mean, when we first opened negotiations with the owner of the property, he offered us the option of like, why don't you guys, I'll give you your space and then you can find tenants for me, but they'll pay me rent. And we decided, no, we want to take our responsibility for the whole place and do everything we can to keep that rent as low as possible. And yes, of course, we will also be paying rent to organize it as a collective rather than to be part of his money collection structure.
Yeah.
You know, has been the thing that has enabled us to keep the studios affordable for as long as we have been, and really ends up being like the issue that is driving us out is his explicit desire to make more money on this real estate.
I wanted to say earlier, you talked a lot about the things we can do to try to improve the situation or take advantage of the situation, but you said gentrification is inevitable. Do you think it's inevitable as we try to find ways to either stop it or make it less damaging?
You go first.
I mean, I think within the capitalist framework that we all are, you know, imprisoned in, it's a bit intense. There are so many marginal communities, activist communities, and family structures, and individuals, and queer communities, and, you know, BIPOC communities that are not daily, on the daily, countering and questioning and acting outside that framework. But because, yes, we live in the structure that we live in, the framework that we live in, I think gentrification in cities is inevitable.
Yeah, sure, because there's people with far more funds to push things through so that they can maximize their profits, etc.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, it's important to remember that the system we live in is entirely constructed and can be modified. And in many other markets, heavy regulation is necessary to ensure that those markets don't kill the planet, don't put people in danger, and a whole range of other values get brought in and, you know, codified and enforced by law, by governments, to ensure that undesirable, unintended aspects of markets are the most beneficial and the least harmful. And the real estate market is no exception. They're already very, very heavily regulated, but you need to look at the point of those regulations in terms of who they benefit. And you need to look at enforcement. How enforced are they? If any fine that any company can pay is only a tiny percentage of the profit they made by breaking the rules, they are only incentivized to continue to break the rules.
Because there have been cities, like I think in Berlin, they stopped rent increase, right?
I was just reading recently in the Netherlands that many municipalities are enacting laws that cap foreign ownership of residential properties, in order to ensure that those properties are still available on the local market for local buyers to actually live in. There are lots and lots of things that I think that can be done to stop gentrification. I think you can't deny that places where human beings live for a long period of time are going to constantly be subject to change, just through the progression of history and ethics and technology and industry and all the rest of that. All of that stuff is, of course, going to change. But I think that there are ways that we can identify harmful or destructive change, or maybe measure those things against the potential benefits, you know, like we have to ask ourselves, where are the poor people in Park X going to go when Park X gets bought up by big corporations whose entire point is to pay tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars over asking price so that they can extract rent in perpetuity? They all have infrastructure that all needs to get paid for that is not present when you live in the house that you own. Mm-hmm. You don't need to make a profit on that.
Yeah, and it's also a basic human right to have a home and to be able to live in dignity, right?
To say that housing is a right and take that statement right up against housing is a commodity. Those two things are incommensurable. They're incompatible. You have to pick one. And it's, you know, it's the same thing with food. You know, it's the same thing with air. Air is a right. And there's a reason that there's not a market for air.
Not yet.
excluding the early 2000s oxygen bar. And it seems like it's like one of those Orwellian doublespeak things where people are very comfortable saying out of the one side of their mouth, housing is a right. And out of the other side of their mouth, I hope I get the most money that I possibly can for my property that I'm selling. Those two things do not go together, cannot go together. And the very best thing we can do without entirely overthrowing capitalism is heavily regulate the market, just like all the other markets.
And those regulations can only really be enacted, I think, maybe I'm being idealistic, through the pressure of organizations, housing organizations that defend the rights of the people. Through that pressure, the government needs to act. Without that pressure, they just go along
but
their merry way.
What do you think the government's role should be if they were to do their job? What should the government be doing?
I think every single property that is like over a certain amount of square footage and possible height needs to integrate like an affordable housing, a proportion of units that are social housing or affordable for starters. And I think they're starting to do that.
Not nearly enough.
In capitalism, any measure that you take has to be market-oriented. So, for example, when we're talking about climate change, we're talking about carbon taxes, which incentivize corporations to lower their carbon footprint so that they don't have to pay so much. And I've seen lots of proposals for how to regulate. One that I saw that was really interesting is, like, any dwelling that you purchase that is not the one that you live in, you triple the property taxes on that, which strongly disincentivizes you from buying it so that you can rent it out, because those property taxes will make it unprofitable to do so.
Yeah, and then there's, like, Airbnb laws. Like, in Rosemont-Petit-Patrie, they created a municipal bylaw where you're not allowed to have a secondary property that is just for Airbnb. You can Airbnb your own place, but no, those empty apartments just constantly being filled by travelers. Yeah. I think in terms of Park X, like, you know, this Beaumont Strip has become, like, kind of a shishi restaurant avenue, and some of the things that I was hoping and I'm still keeping an eye out on is that the owners of these new businesses, these entrepreneurs, take account for their location and make sure that they hire people from the neighborhood and that they do outreach or, I don't know, some kind of give back, fundraising, some kind of gesture, even if it is just a gesture, that that's like a really simple way to like to enter a neighborhood where you're contributing to gentrification. And maybe that's tokenism and it gets tricky, but just for those entrepreneurs to be cognizant of the effects that they're having on the neighborhood.
Well, they're overpriced, so no one who lives in this neighborhood can actually afford to eat at them or buy their clothing or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And will they even feel comfortable walking in?
Exactly.
As racialized people who don't speak the language necessarily well, will they be welcome to go and have a, whatever it is, $7 slice of pizza or buy a $90 jaunty hat? Or
You can't forget that everything that we live in, that we were born and raised in, was constructed, you know, and at the very beginnings of what we call capitalism today, we're defined by landowners saying, I don't want to share this land with everybody anymore. I want to put sheep here so that I can make more money. And if you are not prepared to be, you know, a sheep farmer or somebody who's part of the wool production industry, then too bad for you, you die. And those things were very specifically encoded in, like, starting in, like, the 14th century to make sure that it's not easy to acquire land. That land always has a high price. Who does that benefit? The people who already own the land. So it's one of the cornerstones of capitalism is private property. You can't get away from it. It is what it is. And every aspect of the market is there to protect the interests of the market.
I mean, I think there are ways you can get away from it. And it requires regulation and a change in bylaws and a more flexible banking systems that allow for, let's say, 10 people to buy a property collectively.
Yeah.
Like that in and of itself would just open up so many possibilities.
Yeah, but banks don't like doing that.
No.
They really don't, because it doesn't suit the narrative that their entire business is based on.
No, but there are banks like Desjardins who have like branches, divisions whereby they work toward for grassroots organizations and toward the betterment of society in the collective, because they themselves are supposed to be a co-op bank. It's small, but they're there. There are little inklings of hope within.
Yeah. I mean, and you did talk a lot about the things that you as citizens, people of residents of the neighborhood, and artists can do. So I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about what we all can do or what we all should be doing to make our society better.
Well, yeah. All you have to do is imagine the follow-on effects of housing not being expensive. Developers will always claim, well, construction is expensive and I need to get paid for that. And it's like, of course you do, but like, those wages that you pay for construction would not have to be so high if the cost of living was itself not so high. And the cost of living, always the top thing on the list is like, what do you pay for housing? And if it was cheaper, I wouldn't need to get paid so much, and neither would anybody else. And my God, just think of what that money could do otherwise than just going in the pockets of people who are doing nothing other than owning something. It used to be in the 17th century, King of France was trying to build a navy, and France was one of the largest countries in Europe at the time, and had huge old-growth forests that were full of trees that could be turned into ships. The problem is that the King of France could never get lumber from his forests deep in the heart of France to the coast where you build the ships, because in order to do so, you need to float those logs down rivers. And those rivers were owned in tiny slices by a succession of noblemen. And every nobleman controlled traffic through their tiny little slice. They'd build little castles on promontories to control the river by force. They'd build dams or locks or whatever. And they would extract a tax from everybody who wanted to pass things, even the king, through their little territory. And as a result, you could start at the top of the river with like 1,000 logs, and by the time you get to the coast, you're left with like less than 100, because each single noble person has extracted their profit from your use of their property.
The river.
And as a result, the King of France would actually have to go and contract with lumberjacks in Sweden and Norway to get his lumber floated on the ocean, which nobody owns. Okay. In order to be able to procure that lumber, even though France had tons of lumber, more than anybody else. And that whole situation resulted from the idea that because you control a little piece of the earth, you can suck your little fee out of it. And those fees all add up. And we all pay for them all day, all the time. Every store on Saint-Denis pays like $20,000 a month for the privilege of having a business there. Can you imagine how much cheaper everything that store would sell would be if they didn't have to pay that? It drives businesses going under all the time because they can't meet their single major cost, rent. And it's our mandate at the Long Haul. It's like, it's the single biggest cost in anybody who wants to have a separate space to make art in is rent. And the thing that we can do to help artists most effectively is keep rent cheap for studios that they need to produce their work.
So they can spend more time making art rather than working to pay their bills.
And it's exactly an example of the use of a place for values other than profit. As Vanessa and I have been getting ready to leave this place, we've been looking for co-op apartments for like 2-3 years. And it has been striking how much cheaper housing is when you take the profit motive out of it. When somebody doesn't have to make money on your need to have a place to live, it's a lot cheaper.
Many thanks to Vanessa Yanow and John Tinholt of The Long Haul Studios for sharing their perspectives with us today. For now, The Long Haul is still up and running and still renting affordable art studios. If you want to find out more, you can find them on Facebook and Instagram. Just look up Long Haul Art Studios. This brings us to the end of our Radio Rénoviction broadcast for the month of March 2024. Thanks very much to CKUT Radio and to Jack Solar for finding a space on the airwaves to broadcast these stories. And also a big thank you to our listeners for supporting CKUT during our funding drive. Radio Rénoviction is produced by myself, Caroline Kunzle, Clara Swan Kennedy, and Madeline Lyons. If you'd ever like to tell us your story, please write to us at radiorenoviction@ckut.ca. We'll be back in a month's time on the last Friday of April at 5 p.m. Until then, take good care.
This is Matana Roberts, and you are tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal. Montreal, a city that I love, 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 love.
Cinema Politica invites you to the theatrical release of Silvicola starting from March 22nd, with opening weekend screenings followed by a Q&A with award-winning director Jean-Philippe Marquis. At a time when the planet's old-growth forests are threatened as never before, Jean-Philippe Marquis has crafted a dazzling and unsettling film essay on forestry practices in the Pacific Northwest, home to the world's tallest trees. Juxtaposing sublime aerial imagery with Vérité workplace footage, he meets people whose livelihood is connected to the forest economy and culture, tempering a critique of neoliberal forestry practices with an up-close understanding for people who labor within the system. The opening weekend of Silvicola will take place at the Cinémathèque Québécois and Cinéma Public, with screenings starting from Friday, March 22nd. For more information, go to cinemapolitica.org/film/Silvicola. We hope to see you there.
Black Theater Workshop presents Every Day She Rose by Andrea Scott and Nick Green. After the Black Lives Matter protest at the 2016 Toronto Pride Parade, two friends find their racial and queer politics aren't as aligned as they thought. Don't miss the Montreal premiere of Every Day She Rose at Théâtre Espace Libre from April 3rd to the 14th. Visit blacktheaterworkshop.ca to book your tickets today. This is a Black Theater Workshop production and CKUT co-presentation.
Sego.
Buju, Anim.
Danach A. Ak Anzenu Shukwithan.
Tante.
Hey, Inuhadikai.
Words and Culture weaves conversations with Indigenous language and knowledge keepers to learn, celebrate, and connect. Join us as we delve into distinct Indigenous language families, beginning in February.
Thank you. Run, run, run. Thank you. Bienvenue à Café, votre émission d'art et de culture préférée du vendredi soir sur les ondes de CKUT. Aujourd'hui, Lynn reçoit l'artiste Émile Bourgault en direct au studio. On aura aussi quelques moments musicaux, mais tout d'abord, chers auditeuristes, j'ai la chance de m'entretenir avec l'artiste montréalaise multidisciplinaire Geneviève Feuillard. Tout d'abord, petite mise en contexte, Geneviève, je te connais depuis quand même quelques années. On gravite autour des mêmes cercles de personnes, mais c'est tout particulièrement à l'été 2022 que j'ai été plus proche de ton art. La création d'une fournaise archaïque, je te laisse continuer.